You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, May the 6th. We're going to talk about food prices this hour and the global food crisis and what's behind it and what the link is between biofuels and food prices and what can be done about all of the riots we're seeing going on all over the world. Most recently, just a day ago in Somalia, tens of thousands of people rioting over high food prices in Somalia's capital, hurling stones and prompting hundreds of shops to close. Several people appeared to be injured in the protest in Mogadishu. The protesters included women and children who began marching to protest the refusal of traders to accept old shilling notes. Soon after, tens of thousands of people took to the streets, hurling stones that smashed the windshields of several cars and buses. Also, in the headlines, the Asian Development Bank says 1 billion poor people in Asia need food aid and sound fiscal policies to cope with skyrocketing food prices. The bank's president says people's purchasing power has been eroded, and that's placing them at a greater risk of hunger and malnutrition. We are going to talk about this global food crisis with the author of the new book, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. And we'll welcome the questions that you have about what's going on. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We are happy to have with us Raj Patel. He is currently a researcher at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, a visiting scholar at the Center for African Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. He's worked for the Food Bank, interned at the WTO, consulted for the UN, and been involved in international campaigns against his former employers. He's also a fellow now at Food First. He writes for the Los Angeles Times and The Guardian, and his most recent book is Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you so much for being with us. Now, you also were asked to testify before Congress coming up next week, right?
That's right, yes. The House Financial Services Committee, which provides the money to organizations like the World Bank, is keen to find out what's going on and why it is, or how it is, rather, that the World Bank is linked to the current food crisis.
Now, how is the World Bank linked?
Well, I mean, there are two big things happening in the world, one of which is recent and one of which is long-term. The recent thing is this huge spike in the price of food. Now, that in and of itself is very, very hard on poor people. But the other thing that's going on is that the protections that would have provided some sort of a buffer against this kind of event have, over the past 30 years, been eroded. And they've been eroded because the World Bank is insisting on certain kinds of economic policy. And it's not just the World Bank, of course. There's a suite of international organizations. And, it's part of U.S. Foreign policy as well as European foreign policy, to prevent developing countries from doing things like stockpiling grain and from having grain stores in which they let out in events such as these. Stuff like that and policies like income support for the very poorest people. Those kinds of programs have been shriveled and shrunk under what has been known as structural adjustment policies. And so the upshot of it is that now we're facing a situation where the prices are going up and there's nothing that the communities can rely on to cushion the blow, and the blow is hitting very hard indeed. And again, that's largely because of the way that World Bank policy has been crafted over the past 30 years.
Yeah, describe for us how big of a blow this is. What is the scope of this food crisis globally?
Bear in mind that in a good year, before we ever started worrying about the food crisis, 850 million people went hungry every year. That was a good year. That was in 2006. Since then, the price of food has gone up, and you know, in some cases, doubled or tripled. Of course, people's incomes haven't doubled or tripled at all. So for people living on, say, $2 a day, who are spending more than half their income on food, now the price of food has doubled, they absolutely don't have enough money. And it would not be unreasonable to expect the number of people going hungry in the world to hit a billion. The way that people cope with severe hunger is ingenious and it's heartbreaking. In Haiti, for example, people were eating mud cakes.
Yeah.
These are sort of the cakes made of soil and margarine and salt. But it helped to sort of keep the edge off hunger. But in the end, actually, in Haiti, there were food riots. Food riots against the government, and 7 people were killed in those riots. The food riots, as you notice, are not just restricted to Haiti; they're sweeping the world.
Yeah. Now, why are the prices going up so much? Why is there not enough food in Haiti, and why are they eating mud pies?
Well, I mean, Haiti's a really interesting example. It was forced by a series of U.S. governments, actually, and also by the World Bank and the IMF, to liberalize its rice imports in particular. In other words, Haitian rice farmers had to compete against U.S. rice farmers. This is the level playing field, apparently. This is what the World Bank and the World Trade Organization insist is the proper way for developing countries to move forward is to be exposed to the free market and to maximize their efficiency. But what happened, of course, was that Haitian rice farmers were absolutely sort of blown out of the water, and so Haiti was able to grow the majority of its rice in the 1980s, and now virtually none of it comes from Haiti. And in fact, if you go to Haiti, you'll see that all the rice that people are struggling over comes in bags that say "Gift of the People of the United States." So you have that going on at the same time as the bigger picture, the reason for these huge price increases. Well, very quickly, there are 5 reasons. One is the price of oil, and that's not just because our food is transported long distances, but because fertilizers, for example, are very dense in fossil fuel. So the price of oil goes up, price of fertilizer goes up, price of food goes up. The second reason is a growing demand for meat from rich countries, but now increasingly from developing countries. Mm-hmm. And meat means that grain gets transferred from the bowls of people who can only afford to eat meat into animals. So that drives up the price of grain. Third reason is biofuels. In some crops, particularly corn, there's been an effect of driving food prices up because food is being transformed into fuel rather than is being intended to be eaten. On top of that, there have just been bad harvests. Some people say this is climate change, and certainly we can expect to see more of those odd climatic events, droughts when there shouldn't be, those sorts of things. And finally, one that we're not hearing so much about, speculation. We're just coming out of a real estate bubble in this country. And real estate, the bubble was created purely by people's expectations of an increase in price. We're kind of seeing this happening with food. The food price speculation is driving the price of food up, and a few grain trading companies and hedge funds are making a lot of money from that.
I'm seeing a story here on the Associated Press about the Asian Development Bank and the bank's annual meeting going on right now. It says that 4 rice-exporting nations are discussing a proposal to form a cartel to help control the price of rice. Cambodia's prime minister says, unlike OPEC, the purpose would be to ensure global food stability. Other countries considering forming the cartel are Laos, Myanmar, Thailand, which proposed the idea. Is that what we're going to see happening?
I hope. I can fully understand why the world's largest rice exporting countries, and Thailand is the world's largest rice exporter. Well, I can understand why they would be, given that they're sitting on a resource that is in very short supply but in very high demand at the moment. I mean, a fifth of all the calories consumed on Earth by humans it comes from rice.
Mm-hmm.
So they've, you know, they're certainly in a position to be able to ride the wave that they're on at the moment. But I mean, I can certainly see that there is a trend among countries that have food exporting capabilities for protectionism, for them getting, you know, trying to profit from this crisis, and in a sense, you know, also to protect their own people from the price shocks. China, for example, is the world's largest rice producer. They don't export too much, but they produce a great deal, and they are very worried indeed about social unrest because of the price of food. So, you know, what, in a sense, one can't blame countries for getting defensive in times like this. But, of course, the people who get hurt then are the poorest people outside those countries who can't even, you know, whose ability to access food is compromised.
Yeah. We're talking with Raj Patel. He is a analyst for Food First, currently a visiting scholar at the UC Berkeley Center for African Studies. He is also the author of the new book, Stuffed and Starved: The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question or thought about the global food crisis. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. I hope you'll stay tuned and join in after 8 o'clock tonight. We will bring you results and analysis of the primary results in Indiana and North Carolina. An NPR News special tonight starting at 8 o'clock and a political call-in after 9 o'clock. Neil Conan will be on hand to talk with you and callers across the nation as you react to today's primaries in North Carolina and Indiana. We'll have more results and analysis of the two primaries tomorrow morning on this program. Right now, we're talking about what's behind rising food prices, what's behind the global food crisis, what's the link between biofuels and food, and food prices. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, the author of the new book, Stuffed and Starved: The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, Raj Patel. And our first caller is Bill in Elm Grove. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, and welcome to your guest. Enjoying it a lot.
Thank you.
Behind the oil and energy, nobody seems to mention the war in Iraq. The price of oil was $32 a barrel when Bush came into office. Now it's four times that. And to to talk about the price of oil without talking about this war in Iraq and the destabilization it has brought about in the Middle East is it's confusing. And so let's put the blame, at least part of the blame, for this price of food, price of energy, on Bush, Cheney, McCain, and Hillary Clinton.
Okay.
They all wanted the war.
Is that fair, Raj?
Actually, Bill's on the money. Some people have said that the war in Iraq is actually a war for the oil that we eat. And I mean, it's true that the war in Iraq has done a great deal of harm to the price of oil and brought about a great deal of uncertainty about oil supplies. But the reason it hurts our food so much is because it takes a calorie of fossil fuel, more than a calorie of fossil fuel, to grow every calorie of food that we eat under modern industrial agriculture. So, you know, it's sort of a conjunction of a number of circumstances. When the price of oil goes up, also what invariably happens is that there's a recession, and so the number of people who are able to afford food decreases. You know, everyone's salaries kind of goes down, incomes stagnate, and that means that people get hit hard in their pocketbooks. I mean, we're seeing this in the United States, by the way. In a good year, 35.5 million Americans went hungry in 2006, and we can expect that figure to be much higher now. So that, I mean, the current economic crisis has quite a lot to do with the very high price of oil. But again, it's also to do with the way that we produce food. because being hitched to this model of industrial agriculture that requires so much fossil fuel means that we're very vulnerable to the effects of high oil prices. And the, you know, the warmongering in Iraq has only fueled that.
Speaking of fuel, talk some more about the link between biofuels and food prices and the food crisis. I've heard some farmers and others saying, "Hey, don't blame us. No one's going to be eating this, cattle corn that we're making into ethanol."
Well, but I think that's the point that actually there's a. There are some very clear market signals sent out by the government's sponsorship of the transformation of food into fuel, and those signals are that it makes you will make more money if you grow things that people don't eat, but things that people burn instead, mm-hmm. rather than if you grow food, and that not only means that ethanol, so corn is being grown that is not for human consumption, but also that land is being pulled out of production for other things, mm-hmm. and turned into corn, which happened last year. This year is a different story. But there's also a rider to that, which is that because of the shift in cultivation, there's uncertainty in the financial markets. And that means that the price of U.S. yellow corn goes up. But then the price of white corn in Mexico also gets bid up by speculators, for example, who think that there's going to be some substitution between white and yellow. But that means that in Mexico last year there were tortilla riots as a result of the uncertainty and the increases in white corn in white corn prices, and that again derives from the biofuels policy. I mean, even George Bush has said that biofuels are, by his estimation, responsible only for 15% of the increase in food prices that we've seen at the moment. But that's quite a chunk. There is some very clear linkage between mm-hmm. This biofuels policy and the food price rises we're seeing at the moment.
Now, President Bush is getting criticized for comments he made on Friday about the rising price of food. Politicians in India are blasting him for suggesting that the South Asian country's increasing prosperity is partly to blame for the rising cost of food. Bush was praising the growing prosperity of countries like India when he said that the wealth leads people to start demanding better nutrition and better food, and said that higher demand causes the price to go up. So was President Bush off base there?
Well, I mean, I think he was. I mean, for a start, he said the Indian middle class, which is 350 million strong, but of course, The Indian middle class is actually about a seventh of that. There are only 50 million of them, at most. But he seems to be sort of deflecting mm-hmm. the blame to Asia. And in fact, if you read the New York Times, for example, you'll see a similar trend where Asians in India and China are being blamed for the current crisis because the Indians want milk and the Chinese want pork. All of a sudden, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. And that's very thinly veiled racism, to be honest. Because if we look at levels of unsustainable food consumption, we should look a little closer to home. There is not enough planet, no matter how we grow our food, for the world to eat as much meat and to eat as with such profligacy as America does. And that's not something that the president will be saying anytime soon. It's much more convenient for him to blame, a relative handful of people in India, rather than to look for the source of the food price rises closer to home. I mean, there is a small extent to which increased meat consumption is and demand for dairy in Asia is driving up the price. But that's been going on for 20, 30 years. It's not like yesterday, all of a sudden, everyone wanted cheese and pulled pork. This is a sort of gradual trend. And so blaming the middle classes in these countries for something that is a structural problem, I think, is a way of absolutely not addressing the problem at all.
Next, we go to Habu in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Well, it's very good to hear this guest. Very refreshing and and novel ideas. In any case, as I was saying last time, for the most part, the mafia trio of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the WTO have forced these little countries to adjust their policies, which means they have to lower their own tariffs. They have to grow products, plants like cut flowers for export to the West, and also they have to open up their markets to the onslaught of subsidized Western grain. So this completely displaces people from producing their own food. The good thing is, with the high prices, people will be coming back to the land. But this is my question, and I hope Mr. Patel will tell the listeners about the Malawi experiment. But this is my question for you. You know, that this country and the West have been going gaga about biofuels. And even if we go to switchgrass, forget corn, and the moment that the land is tied to energy prices, and energy prices are probably not coming down anything short of $60 a barrel, that means that even if corn prices come down, but they won't, if people are growing switchgrass for biofuels, with that kind of support of $60 a barrel, farmers will go to switchgrass. They'll plow up forests. They'll, instead of producing corn, because corn will never, a corn farmer, instead of getting a few dollars per bushel, will say, oh, I can make get switchgrass and get $60 a barrel. That's the flow. So inherently, the whole program of tying oil to the land or biofuel to the land is an inherently an unstable one, and we'll see food prices forever be very much higher. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Habu. Is he right?
Yes, he's absolutely right. I mean, it is certainly the case that oil prices are going to remain high. In fact, yeah, I don't see any reason why the price of oil should go below $100 a barrel, frankly. To be perfectly frank, I don't see any reason why it shouldn't go much, much higher than it is at the moment. Because, you know, the structural reasons for an increase in demand are just not going anywhere. We are heading towards a future where more and more countries and people are dependent on oil because we have such a lunatic biofuels and energy policy. Not biofuels, but a lunatic energy policy where we are hitching ourselves even more closely to a resource that's running out and is expensive and is causing climate change. So he's absolutely right about the effects of hitching land to oil. That's a very powerful image, I think.
Yeah. What's the Malawi experiment?
Okay, what happened? I mean, Malawi had for a very long time high levels of malnutrition, and then there was sort of a small uptick in the amount of food they have, and the IMF told them to auction off their grain supply to pay off their debt. So under IMF instruction, that's what they did, and then there was big hunger the year after, and so the Malawian government decided to buck the IMF and World Bank's advice and just ignored it and started subsidizing fertilizer for farmers. And because of this, and because they gave support to local farmers, the amount of food produced went way up. As a result, Malawi is doing much better in this food crisis than some of its neighbors in the Southern African region. And there's an important lesson here, the lesson is that governments need to support local agriculture. It's a lesson that many countries are learning almost at gunpoint now, because that they can't afford the price of food imports, and also the price of fertilizers is going up, which means that the option that Malawi took in terms of subsidizing fertilizers at a very high level might not be open to countries in the future. But there is an option, which is to support local farmers and to increase soil fertility, not through industrial agriculture, but through a different kind of agriculture. There was a big report came out a couple of weeks ago, sort of like an international panel of experts, like the climate change panel, and with similar provenance, but for food. And they asked the question, well, how are we going to feed the world? The answer they came up with was It's not going to be industrial, you know, fossil fuel-based agriculture. It's not going to be genetically modified agriculture. But it's going to be local, sustainable, and, you know, agricultural techniques that build soil fertility, like agroecology, you know, intercropping things and you know, sort of rotating, and you know, certain kinds of farming technique and science that require investment and support from the government. And I think that that's the important lesson to take away from Malawi. It's not necessarily that subsidizing fertilizer is the magic bullet, but certainly subsidizing and supporting research and science into the best kind of sustainable technology for your farmers. That's definitely a way to go, and if that means ignoring the World Bank and the IMF, so much the better.
Next, we go to Thomas in Manitowoc. Hi, Thomas, you're on the air.
Hi, I agree with all the factors that your guest has stated. He's very knowledgeable, but I still am not too optimistic until we address our overpopulation control on the Earth. Because I think that with all the primitive cultures and religions we have, where women are oppressed and these huge populations just keep on building, I just don't see how these other factors can be as strong as the overpopulation problem we have.
Right. Is that should that be one of the factors behind all of this?
Well, yeah, the population is the population issue is always a thorny one, because historically the kinds of people who have agonized about population tend to be rich white people who are worried and motivated by certain kinds of fears of how people in developing countries are going to multiply like, you know, like locusts and sweep over the world. And I think that's certainly something that we would not want to encourage right now. But there is something. I mean, you know, we are going to be heading towards a world of 9 billion people. Now, what's the way to address that? I mean, in India in the 1970s, there was a program of sterilization in exchange for radios, and I'm sure no one would advocate that sort of a policy in order to control population. And similarly, I don't think anyone would force people to break with and just, you know, try to destroy religions that encouraged high levels of fertility, because, you know, I mean, you'd be taking on Catholicism, and I don't think anyone wants to do that either. So, but actually, that there is a single policy. I mean, you know, obviously, there's a number of things that need to happen, but the one policy that has been demonstrated time and again to provide an amazing benefit in terms of population is girls' education. And I think anyone who is concerned about population really needs to be very concerned about insisting that governments around the world are being provided with the resources to allow girls to be educated, because there is no single policy that is more connected to the idea of that allows women to control their fertility, be able to have the confidence and the power to be able to decide the size of their own families than girls' education. So, I mean, if the issue here is that we should get serious about population, then I agree, we should get very serious about girls' education.
Next, we go to Mike in Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Very interesting program. Mm-hmm. The thing is that I think we're all missing the point, and I think the point is that what is happening is, as the world's population increases, we're starting to see the beginning of what I call the resource war. You know, it's oil, it's grain, it's going to be water, and, you know, it's kind of scary to think how are politicians going to, you know, use and utilize the different resources any particular country may have in the future to control life on Earth. It's the beginning of what I call the resource war.
Is that a fair assessment, Raj?
Well, I mean, there is already a history of wars over resources. I mean, and in fact, quite a long one. I mean, there are some people who go back and say that actually the first world war over resources was World War One, and there's there is an agrarian interpretation of how and why countries fought World War One. But I think There is an issue of increasing competition for resources, but I mean, I think that only leads to to apocalypse if we are absolutely not prepared to address the fact that there is inequality in distribution of those resources and that we are hitched to those resources. One of the ways of getting out of the way of these resource conflicts, which I agree. I mean, the war in Iraq is a resource conflict, and there are cross-border conflicts about water and a range of other things. And now, of course, the possibility exists of conflicts over food. But again, I mean, the only reason that we have these conflicts is because there is such an inequality in the distribution of these resources, and we are so dependent on them. And that's that has everything to do not only with the resources such as oil and water, but things like money. I mean, the reason that people don't get to eat on this planet is not because there is insufficient food. I think this is very important to bear in mind. If what we were doing was fighting over just a few grains of food across the world, then that would be a serious resource war. But actually, what we're fighting for is to sustain unsustainable lifestyle and levels of consumption. Because, as I say, there is enough food to feed the planet. The problem is, the way we distribute it is according to the basis of ability to pay. We use markets to distribute food. And that means that some people get to eat quite a lot. That means some people get to eat meat, which is huge in terms of its footprint in the food system. And some people don't get to eat at all.
Our guest is Raj Patel. He is a researcher at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, a visiting scholar at the Center for African Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. He has worked for the World Bank, interned at the WTO, consulted for the UN, and been involved in international campaigns against his former employers. He is a fellow at Food First. He'll be testifying before Congress next week about the role of the World Bank in the food crisis and rising food prices. And he is the author of the new book, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. With the price at the pump steadily increasing, some are calling for a gas tax holiday. After 9, Kathleen and her guests will examine a plan that would temporarily lower gas prices and how it might benefit American pocketbooks. Talking about the possibility, the proposal for a gas tax holiday after 9 o'clock this morning. Also welcoming in NPR's Melissa Block to talk about special coverage of the Indiana and North Carolina primaries. That's in our next hour. We're talking about food prices, the global food crisis, the riots going on in countries around the world over food shortages. Our guest is Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. And our next caller is Stephen Wassa. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I heard a show maybe 3 weeks ago on public radio, and it's regarding technology and DNA, that they figure they can fool the corn plant into producing an extra ear of corn. And my observation around Wassa here is that they chop up the leaves and the stalk of the corn and just leave it in the field. Can we make the biofuels out of the leaves and the stalk versus the corn itself?
It's a good question, Steve. I don't think that there are ways of genetically modifying corn to be able to seriously overcome some of the resource and energy costs involved in turning corn into ethanol. I mean, the problem with corn is that it takes more energy and produces more CO2 to turn corn into ethanol than it saves. So it's a net energy and CO2 sink. But there are some technologies. People are experimenting with kinds of bacteria that you can grow off in the sea to be able to turn into fossil fuels. And other people are experimenting with switchgrass and kinds of other technologies. Now, the offshore, you know, cyanobacteria, they're called, it seems to me a very promising technology. But in the interim, we still need to remember that, actually we need to be changing our energy needs. A little bit of tweaking with a little bit of messing around with corn is not going to solve our dependence on food. Our dependence on fossil fuel. So I certainly think that that's something we need to be addressing more forcefully rather than trying to get an extra ear of corn onto the cob.
Next, we go to Daniel in Rice Lake. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. I don't know if it's true, but I've heard the world has 22 days of food reserves. And because of the vagaries in climate change, the world faces an uncertain future where droughts and climatic changes might drastically reduce food production. Isn't it imperative to build food stockpiles while surpluses continue?
Thanks, Dan. That's a great question. I hadn't heard the 22 day supply number, but I certainly think that food stockpiling is a very good idea, and in fact, this is increasingly an idea that's recognized not only on the left side of the political spectrum but the right as well, because without those buffers, without that kind of safety, there's every chance that a food shock can lead to unpleasant social change. I think, you know, in fact, in Stuffed and Starved, I tell the story of how vulnerable Britain was to something that was entirely unrelated to food, which is that in Britain a few years back we had a truckers' oil strike where truckers blockaded oil refineries because they were protesting the high price of gasoline. And as a result, the number of freight journeys undertaken on British roads was reduced by a tenth or something. A real fraction of trips were taken on the road. But as a result of that, supermarkets in Britain were within hours of running out of food after just a few days of the blockade. That really wasn't about a shortage of food. It was about frailty within the logistics system that brings us our food from halfway around the world and that is hitched again to fossil fuels and hitched to not worrying about local production of food, but depending on food being grown on the other side of the planet. So I certainly agree that food stocks need to be increased, but also the location of those stocks needs to be near where people live. And that means allowing countries to be able to have their own domestic farm policy. And right now, as I say, the World Bank and the IMF don't let developing countries do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of us were shocked when we heard that stores like Costco and Sam's Club were rationing the sale of bags of rice. What did you make of that?
Well, I mean, that was because the price of long grain rice, jasmine rice and basmati rice, has gone up because of these harvest failures and irregularities in Southeast Asia and South Asia. If you wanted to go to Costco or Sam's Club and buy, a pallet full of short grain American rice, that would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But they were restricting long grain rice because the people who want long grain rice, say, for example, Asian communities here or Asian restaurants, for example, you can't substitute short grain rice for long grain rice. It doesn't taste the same, and if you're having a Chinese meal, you'll notice. Or an Indian meal for that matter, or any kind of Southeast Asian meal or a South Asian meal. So that was certainly a small ripple effect that we feel here. But actually, in the Philippines right now, there's a bigger version of that, where people are hoarding rice because they expect the price of rice to go up. And the government is taking some very aggressive steps to try and find people who are hoarding rice and making them distribute it or selling it. And that's important because, this is how famines happen. In the classic study of famines in 1943, in the Bengal famine in India, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, Amartya Sen, observed that there was sufficient food to feed everyone. The reason that people died was because there was hoarding going on. A few people were able to buy up a bunch of food and keep it behind locked doors because they knew the price would rise. And, the price did rise. They made a ton of cash. But in the meantime, the people who couldn't afford food died. So the ripple effect that we're seeing in terms of weird things happening at Sam's Club is at its epicenter, has the potential to be widespread famine.
An email from Tom in Oshkosh. Many developing countries are losing their forest to cooking wood. The dropped leaves from the trees are burned instead of being composted to improve soil. I would like to see a worldwide UN program to provide solar cookers to developing countries and efficient small wood cookers that would conserve wood when the sun is blocked. What do you think?
I mean, I think that those kinds of ideas are very important. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, I think in addition to solar cookers, I mean, people want basic things like electricity rather than just solar cookers. I mean, some of the work I do in South Africa, for example, is about people who are forced to use whatever they can find to burn for fuel and for light, and as a result, when people live in dense housing, particularly in urban areas, that means that fires can spread like wildfire through communities of poor people, and in addition to solar cookers, which work just fine during the day, there's a need for technologies that work during the night. For people to have light and to be able to have heat in the evening, and for that we need more than solar cookers. We need definitely a sort of a transformation in the way that energy is thought about, generated, and distributed, and that means shifting away from fossil fuel to something more sustainable.
Yeah. You talk about in the book international social movements working to create a more democratic, sustainable food system. Is there something that we can do to contribute to this?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are a number of social movements that are really on this and have been for a very long time. I mean, recently we've been hearing that this food crisis is a silent tsunami. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it's never been silent. It's only been silent because policymakers have had their fingers in their ears. Let's take the example of the World Trade Organization. For most of us in the United States, we heard about the World Trade Organization in 1999 because of the protests that happened in Seattle.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
But 7 years before that, the charter text for the World Trade Organization had been translated into an Indian language, into Kannada, and was being discussed in the field in India by a movement of over 20 million farmers. They've been discussing this and thinking about it and providing alternatives for a long time. And essentially what they're calling for is a democratic conversation about food, like proper democracy, so that people can have a serious conversation about how food circulates within their community, how to ensure that everyone gets to eat, how to ensure that the way we grow our food is sustainable. But that kind of conversation has been denied us. And I think the sort of clarion call from movements around the world, including within the United States, by the way, the National Family Farm Coalition, is also very keen on this idea that actually what we need is food sovereignty. We need a way of having a democratic conversation about food. And within the U.S., joining in that process means getting much more active in local and a national democracy around food issues.
Rick in La Crosse is with us now. Yeah. Hello, Rick.
Hi. I just wanted to quote The Little Prince if you've ever read The Little Prince, he said that the majority, la plupart de l'humanité, the majority of humanity could fit dans le moindre petit îlot du Pacifique, in the smallest island of the Pacific. And that was true in World War II before Michel de Saint-Exupéry went down over North Africa in his airplane. We have a larger population, but then in 1980 I made the calculation and I found that most of humanity could fit standing room only within the state of Texas. So we really haven't, it's a problem of distribution. It's a problem of allocation of resources and means of production. And the subsidies that the farmers in the Europe, European Union, and the United States give their farmers cannot the South, North-South divide cannot be bridged when the North is subsidized and the South is flooded with commodities from the North.
Well, first, you agree that it is a problem of distribution and allocation, Raj?
Of course I do, yes. I think that's exactly right. I mean, as I was saying before, I mean, there isn't enough world to be able to sustain the kinds of consumption we have in the United States. I mean, Gandhi was on this as well, but, you know, back in the 1940s when he was saying, you know, it took the entire world to support a country like Britain. How many worlds would it take to support a country like India? I mean, that kind of intuition is, I think, exactly right. But also, I mean, I think the second point there is also right. The playing field is very tilted against farmers in developing countries, but it's also tilted against small farmers in this country. I mean, these huge subsidies are not going to the little house on the prairie; they're going to large-scale agribusiness and large-scale farmers. Now, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the need for farmers to be able to get some kind of income support. I'm not sympathetic that you know, multi-million-dollar corporations deserve that kind of support, but I think farmers do, because they provide so many services to the environment and to communities, or they could provide, you know, big environmental services and certainly sort of community building kinds of services. So I think supporting farmers is a very good idea, particularly, you know, now that we see how dependent we all are on food. It's important to start supporting sustainable agriculture and supporting farmers. But, of course, the way that farm supports work in the U.S. and the European Union is not really to go for the little guy. It's to go for the big guy and to prop up it's corporate welfare. It's not sustainable. And so I think we do need to think about shifting the way that we subsidize and support our agriculture so that other countries can do the same.
Well, we'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
The pleasure's mine, Joy.
Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. He'll be testifying before Congress next week as the House is looking into the role of the World Bank in the global food crisis. Raj Patel is also a visiting scholar at the Center for African Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. Thanks very much to Carmen Jackson for producing this program. Thanks to Christina Taylor for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. Tomorrow at this time, we're going to be talking with the author of the book Crunched, about our current economic situation that we're feeling personally and experiencing throughout the country. Crunched tomorrow morning between 8 and 9. 1-800-747-7444 is the number you can call if you'd like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.